TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. John Campbell, Coronavirus Community Testing and Diagnosis. In his August 7 presentation, the British retired nurse teacher, Dr. John Campbell, used his daily COVID briefing to present what might be a breakthrough in testing. Given that testing all over the world is inadequate or even impossible at the scale needed, and that a diagnosis based on cough and fever may not cover enough symptoms to have an unambiguous diagnosis, he described a new COVID symptom study and app. This initiative was led by Professor Tim Spector in the UK and Dr. Andy Chan in the US, and was covered by the journal Science in March and peer-reviewed in Nature. This app collects daily information from individuals in the community about whether they feel well, and if not, their specific symptoms, and if they have been tested for COVID-19. The authors say that this work has led to the development of accurate models of COVID infection rates in the absence of sufficient population testing. Professor Tim Spector said, quote, "Our results suggest that loss of taste or smell is a key early warning sign of COVID-19 infection and should be included in routine screening for the disease." Dr. John Campbell was especially intrigued by this discovery.
Here's a piece of mint I just picked from my tub of mint this morning. Now, I wish you could smell that. It is absolutely gorgeous. Nothing like fresh herbs. I tend to drink mostly tea, actually, but this is coffee from the cupboard. I love the smell of coffee. So I luxuriated there in the smell of mint and the smell of coffee, so I haven't got anosmia at the moment, to give the rather crude demonstration. But that's all you do. You know, you're just testing your sense of smell, and that is the most accurate predictor, according to this study at the moment. Now, it's not saying that the fever and the cough's not important. Of course it is, but that can occur in a variety of other illnesses. Now, having said that, if you've got fever or cough or loss of sense of smell, and you can, then get tested, of course. Of course, it is not a substitute for testing. But it is going to be very important for screening around the world, who we're going to select for testing, and of course, where testing is not available.
Taking you back now to the more formal science of Dr. John Campbell's August 7, 2020 briefing on coronavirus community testing and diagnosis.
Well, welcome to today's video. I want to look at a couple of studies today from the King's College Zoe collaboration that are collecting data from millions of people, because I think it's got some quite significant implications for the pandemic at the moment to help us understand it, and for the way it's likely to pan out over the next few months. The kind of bottom line on this study really is that infection already seems to be a lot more common than people think, and about 20% of people are asymptomatic. And this group is working out a way to diagnose the condition accurately without having testing, based on the clinical features, using phone apps to calculate the probability of infection. Now, it's important to stress that if you think you have COVID-19, or think you've been exposed to it, or have got any of the clinical features, then get tested if you possibly can. This sort of sophisticated clinical feature type diagnosis is never instead of a test. Always get tested if you can. But the point is, why this is so important, is if we had a simple test that you could like flick through on your phone to give yourself a probability of diagnosis, this would be massively important in parts of the world where testing is not available. We looked at the situation yesterday in Bolivia, where the testing situation basically has completely fallen apart. So another way to diagnose would be useful. But it's also bringing out lots of interesting stuff. So that's what this video is about. So If you want the detail on that, of course, I'm going to be here. Let's do it. So have you had COVID-19 without knowing it? Well, quite a few people, it turns out, have. A new study reveals at least 1 in 5 people don't show any symptoms. Now, to be fair, this is in one part of the country, in one part of the world. It's London and the southeast of England. So this is an area that did have a lot of cases back in April, May. Now, the thing I liked about this study, in fact, the King's College work in general, is that a lot of the work that's been done, or a lot of stuff that's published, has come from hospital studies. And the patients there are what we would call a self-selecting sample, because you only go to hospital if you're sick. Whereas most of this disease is taking place in the community, because thankfully 80% of people have very mild symptoms of COVID-19. So this community-based research is very important. Now, what this group went on to do is they went on to do antibody testing on blood samples from 432 adults. Now, the King's College group, they've kind of got these relatively small-scale studies. Okay, they do very good stats on it. But then they can combine that with the millions of people that fill out the app. So although this number's small, they've kind of put it in the context of all these millions of people. So I think the data's always worth listening to. Now, so the antibody tested these 432 people, and 12% of those were tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that if this is a reasonably representative sample, if this 432 people is a reasonably representative sample of the population, then that means that 12% of that population group have already had COVID-19. Much higher than the 6% or so published by the Office for National Statistics, which in itself is much higher than the official testing figures, of course. So it looks like we might be further on in this pandemic than we'd thought if 12% of people have already been infected. Now, it's good to be further on than we'd thought. And the good thing about it is that means a lot more people have been infected than we'd thought. And that greatly lowers the infection fatality rate. Because the more people that have been infected compared to the number of people that died, the lower the infection fatality rate. So that would put it well under 0.5%, which would be very encouraging if that was the case. Because we have seen recently some figures of over 1%, which were quite alarming. So 12% infected already. So, you know, that's quite a lot. And that's just from antibody studies. And of course, antibody studies can only underestimate the total number of infections. But they did find out that 19% patients were fully asymptomatic. Now, again, this figure seems to have changed quite a bit. Studies before were showing that quite large percentages of people are asymptomatic. But this study is saying that 19% of people were completely asymptomatic. So it says relatively small percentage, 19% of people completely asymptomatic. But the thing that they're keen to point out, they want to stress, is that this 19% that were asymptomatic are still infectious. This is why we've had these super spreading events, parties and demonstrations and religious services, for example. We looked at some examples of house parties in the United States that were super spreading events. So if 19% of people get completely asymptomatic infections, they can go to this party and have a good time or a good demonstrate or whatever they do. But they would be feeling fine themselves, but asymptomatic. And of course, the people they spread the virus to could be symptomatic, or the people they spread the virus to could spread the virus to someone else who goes on to die from the infection. So it's important to realise that these people, the asymptomatics, albeit a smaller amount than we thought, they're still infectious and can be responsible for super spreading events. Now, the other thing this study showed is 27% who had antibodies and experienced symptoms didn't have the three core symptoms. So what the NHS has been saying for ages, the National Health Service, is these are your characteristic clinical features: persistent cough, new cough, fever, and loss of the sense of smell are the key features. Well, yeah, that's important in most people. That's important in 73% of people, is it? Anyway, 27% of people don't have that classic triad. So that means we've been missing out quite a few people that could be going on to spread the infection. In other words, it shows the importance of testing, but it shows the limitations of a simple diagnostic criteria like this. But what the study did find is that the specificity, so the loss of the sense of smell, was highly predictive of COVID-19, the loss of the sense of smell. And what they did was they compared that to fever, cough and anosmia combined, and they actually got a lower correlation there. Now, how can that be? Well, the thing is, you can get fever, cough in lots of other conditions as well. It's not as specific. But the anosmia, the loss of the sense of smell, turned out to be the most specific feature. This is the important one. Ah, here's a piece of mint I just picked from my tub of mint this morning. Now, I wish you could smell that. It is absolutely gorgeous. No, you can't smell it, can you? Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Just to rub it in your fingers and nothing like fresh herbs. I tend to drink mostly tea, actually, but this is coffee from the cupboard. I love the smell of coffee. So I luxuriated there in the smell of mint and the smell of coffee, so I haven't got anosmia at the moment, to give the rather crude demonstration. But that's all you do. You know, you're just testing your sense of smell, and that is the most accurate predictor, according to this study at the moment. Now, it's not saying that the fever and the cough's not important. Of course it is, but that can occur in a variety of other illnesses. Now, having said that, if you've got fever or cough or loss of sense of smell, and you can, then get tested, of course. Of course, it is not a substitute for testing. But it is going to be very important for screening around the world, who we're going to select for testing, and of course where testing is not available, as we've already mentioned, in that Bolivia, that terrible Bolivian situation yesterday, where the testing regime has simply gone to pieces along with the healthcare provision. So loss of sense of smell is highly predictive compared to the combination of all three symptoms. So what it's saying is we need a more sophisticated way to do this. But the loss of the sense of smell is the best one. Now, around half of the app users who reported symptoms that were highly predictive of COVID-19 did not have the antibodies. So they've worked out this way, which we'll be looking at, of working out who's had COVID-19 from the symptoms. But about half of them didn't have the antibodies. So we know that as many as 12% had the antibodies, indicating they'd had it. Well, what this is saying is there's another chunk of people as well as those who have had it. So that means the figure in this particular area, if this is a representative sample, London and the southeast of England, the number of people that have had it is the 12% who had the antibodies plus the people who had symptoms which were very probably COVID-19 but didn't have the antibody response. So again, what does that mean? 18% perhaps? You know, it's higher than we'd thought. Confirming other studies showing that the current antibody tests is missing a substantial fraction of cases. In other words, antibody testing can only underestimate the number of people that have actually been infected. Because the antibodies aren't going to last for long. So maybe the antibodies weren't made in the first place. Maybe they faded quickly. Because if you've had this infection in February, there's no point testing for antibodies now because they don't last that long. So you could miss the window of opportunity for testing. Another reason that antibody studies can only underestimate the total number of people that have been infected. Now, they're looking into T cells. Now, what happens here is, we have mentioned this before, but we have these lymphocytes. So we have these B and T lymphocytes. So the T lymphocytes tell the B lymphocytes to make the antibodies. The B lymphocytes then make the antibodies, but the cells that actually make the antibodies, the so-called plasma cells, well, they die off fairly quickly. But then the there's a line of memory cells that remembers how to give the instructions to make the antibodies, that remembers how to make the antibodies, and several thousands of these can be left in the circulatory system. So these T cells would confer immunity for much longer than the antibodies. But the tests for those at the moment are quite complicated, so they're looking for simpler tests for the T cells, for example, for the memory cells. And that would tell us who was infected back in February, or hopefully in 3 or 4 years' time, who was tell you who was infected now. You know, it's a longer lasting effect. But what this means, where are we? There we go. What this means is a significant portion of the population in London, the South East, are likely to have been exposed. We know that some of them definitely have, 12% of this sample, according to antibodies, and another chunk as well, according to the clinical features. And about 19% of them didn't show any clinical features. So interesting, but based on a relatively small sample, but still the researchers do make conclusions. What are they saying? It's essential that we all take steps to protect the health of everybody by sticking to social distancing guidelines, sure, social distancing, wearing face masks in public, and following good hygiene. Well, yep, that's fair enough. We knew that, of course, but this confirms it. So we need social distancing, we need face coverings in public areas, and we need good hand hygiene. There's nothing complicated here, is there? But you see, if the 20% that are asymptomatic did that, 19% that are asymptomatic did that, then that would have stopped them infecting other people. If you have symptoms you can't explain, get a swab or saliva test, of course. Protect yourself and the people around you, of course. These results suggest that both swab and antibody testing, that's, of course, the swab test is the antigen testing for the virus itself. These results suggest that both antigen and antibody testing significantly underestimate the extent of coronavirus infections in the population. So it looks like we're further on than we had thought, which is good news. Now, I was intrigued by the group saying that they could predict these symptoms from, or they could predict the likelihood of infection from the symptoms, is what they're saying. So I did a little further digging on that, and they have actually published data on this, because they're developing this new artificial intelligence app that can predict COVID-19 likelihood without a test. Now, again, we stress, go get tested if you think you've got it. But this can be vitally important in many poorer areas of the world, because testing is not going to be available in many African countries, for example. So what they've done is developed a model that's able to predict COVID-19 infection without patients having to be tested. So heck of a good idea. And what they do is they compare people by comparing them who people you've used the app. So by comparing people who've used the app to report their symptoms, like I do, and combining that with information from traditional testing. So the traditional testing, of course, is the antibody and the antigen testing. And they say that this has a great promise for populations where access to testing is limited. Now, this is based on over nearly 3 million people in this study. And they found that 18,401 had a test, and 7,000 of those tests came back positive. So they're dealing with large numbers here. This is very good quality research. COVID-19 type symptoms most likely to be associated with a positive test. So COVID-19 type symptoms most likely to be associated with a positive test. And we'll give you what those are in a minute. They worked that out from that. So what this means is they looked at all these people reporting symptoms, and they looked at these people who were definitely positive. And from that, they were able to work out what symptoms the people that reported who actually tested positive had. And that's in a large sample. So they were able to work this out with some degree of accuracy, it would be hoped. Now, of course, there's a wide range of symptoms caused by COVID-19 compared to cold and flu. So what they're actually saying is COVID-19 is harder to diagnose. And they said that so far, as we looked at just previously, there's a danger of focusing on only fever and cough. But the anosmia is very important. Now, this is where it gets a bit complicated. Anosmia presented in 66% of people testing positive, but was there in 21% of people testing negative. So they developed this model. And what this did was it took into account the people that were testing positive and testing negative for smell in combination with the other clinical features, in combination with the antigen and the antibody data. And I don't pretend to understand the mathematical models that they're using, but we are assured, and they have been peer-reviewed, that they're accurate. And this has been peer-reviewed, and it's published in the journal Nature. So I've no doubt that the mathematical models have been reviewed by clever mathematicians. So they agree that anosmia is a strong predictor. And they can predict with nearly 100% accuracy whether an individual is likely to have had COVID-19. And what they base it on is age and sex and a combination of four key symptoms. Loss of smell or taste. The loss of taste can be independent, but a lot of the sense of taste is related to the sense of smell anyway. Severe or persistent cough, so it's still important. Fatigue and anorexia, skipping meals. So by looking at all the people that reported symptoms, taking the sample of those that tested positive, they're able to work out this model that can give 80% accuracy for predicting the presence of COVID-19. So that's impressive. Now, app users. A lot of app users were unwell. So 800,000 at some point of this nearly 3 million reported that they weren't feeling well. And they worked out using this mathematical model of diagnosis that 17% were likely to have had COVID-19 at that time. So 17.42% were likely to have had COVID. In other words, 17.42% who were unwell were probably unwell with COVID symptoms. And of course, that means the rest, the other 83% or whatever it is, were unwell but did not have the COVID disease. In other words, this model was able to differentiate between those unwell with COVID-19 and those unwell with something else. Because only 17.42% of those that felt unwell actually had COVID, according to their model. Now, prospective trials are now underway. And what this group is doing now is they're moving from mathematical models to artificial intelligence, which of course will learn and improve itself as it goes along. And it really just struck me, if we have artificial intelligence that can diagnose COVID-19 and this system learns to be a more sophisticated diagnostician as it gains experience, it'll get more and more accurate at diagnosing it from the clinical features and the age and the sex and other information about the patient. And that's got implications for a whole range of diseases as well. So this artificial intelligence, artificial learning way of diagnosing disease is probably only going to become more important as time goes on. Now, Jonathan Wolfe, he's the boss of the Zoe, the app side of the study. These initial results suggest that artificial intelligence diagnosis can help significantly without controversial privacy trade-offs. In other words, you don't need to be geolocated to use this app. Professor Tim Spector, the academic in charge, our results suggest that loss of taste and smell is a key early warning sign of COVID-19 infection and should be included in routine screening for the disease. We strongly urge governments and health authorities everywhere to make this information more widely known. Advise anyone experiencing sudden loss of smell or taste to assume that they are effective and to follow the self-isolation guidelines. And that is in addition to them developing the artificial intelligence app. So it's not, instead of testing, get tested if available, but very interesting new developments in terms of surveillance, knowing how we're getting on with this pandemic, how many people are infected, how many people are asymptomatic, how many people have been infected, and how we can use this information to diagnose people that are newly infected at an early stage. But of course, this will only work if we have the social distancing, the mask wearing, the hand hygiene. And of course, crucially, if someone is identified as being positive or likely to be positive, that they go into the 14-day self-isolation. Without that, all this is a waste of time.
That was Dr. John Campbell, retired nurse teacher from England. His daily COVID briefs are on YouTube under Campbell Teaching. Since the beginning of the pandemic, he has walked into his study once or even twice a day and turned the camera on for his welcome and given updates on COVID-19. Always friendly, personal, with the scientific sources for his topics displayed on handmade slides, he explains complicated processes in no-nonsense terms. Dr. John Campbell recorded this lesson on community testing and diagnosis on August 7, 2020. He described a new COVID symptom study and app. It was developed by a consortium of scientists with the goal of collecting information to help healthcare workers, researchers, and public officials to address the COVID-19 outbreak. This initiative was led by Professor Tim Spector in the UK and Dr. Andy Chan in the US, and was covered by the journal Science in March and peer-reviewed in Nature. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.